Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore how research is showing that vitamin E, if you're low in it, damages your brain. Also, why testosterone can help patients with prostate cancer, how increasing lycopene is associated with a lower kidney cancer risk, and how L-carnitine lowers inflammation in heart disease patients. Also, nut consumption is linked to lower death rates. How about that? And cardiovascular disease in men and women? Does declining testosterone play a role? We'll explore it and a lot more on health and healing, including green tea shows promise for oral cancer therapy. Today's one of those days that I wished I had more time because we have so much to share, including from Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. Both parties, Democrats and Republicans, are plagues on humanity. He could have added, and all their supporting agencies, meeting all their think tanks and magazines and media empires. Also today from Chris Hedges from Truth Dig, corporate capitalism is the foundation of police brutality and the prison state. Also today, when a black swan flies over Wall Street's House of Cards by Jerry Croth of Counterpunch. And you've heard how Greece is getting hammered, but that's all right. They figured out a way to save Greece. No, they haven't. It'll only get worse. It's not possible that the Greek population can pay back the debt. It doesn't owe that debt. It never got the money. But I decided to take a look at how many other countries are just as in bad shape and are facing bankruptcy also. The countries will surprise you, and not a word about any of these. So we'll share that. Then, why would 46 senators support burning trees for electricity when it contributes more to climate change than coal? Lucas Ross, Friends of the Earth, explains. Also recently had an opportunity to do a lecture in California for a large group of physicians, both in the center as well as over the internet, on the direction of the power of energy and healing. And these are all Orthodox doctors, and it was well received. I was asked to meet someone, and I chose not to. John Mackey. Why wouldn't I meet the founder of Whole Foods? Well, because I don't like anything he stands for. I made it very clear to the people I wouldn't be in any photo shoots. So today I'll give you one reason from Ben Norton. Because his form of conscious capitalism, it exploits prison labor. Just one of the many pieces of the Whole Foods exploitation area that I'll discuss. Also, Professor Eric Lomas today, my guest in the second part of our program, the catastrophes caused by U.S. corporate outsourcing and how companies manage to avoid labor laws and social change. Why isn't no one's talking about this in any meaningful way? Now, I won't have time today, but I'm going to deal with what happens to the 125,000 adjunct professors who are teaching five classes and they're earning less than a pet sitter. Things we didn't know. So we'll get into many of these. Plus today, a short piece. It's only a minute from Tupac, warning us about rappers like Young Thug and others like him, what they don't get, and how to get fired from Fox News and get your show canceled in less than 5 minutes. This is interesting. You'll find this right on. And a 12-year-old child reveals one of the best-kept secrets in the world. Yeah? Wait till you hear that. So you see, I have so much. I won't be able to get it all on. What I don't get on today, I'll get on tomorrow. Let's begin. First up, vitamin E. I remember holding a conference. I don't know if any of you in this audience remember this conference. It was packed. It was around 1975, and it was at the Waldorf Astoria. It was in their grand ballroom, and I invited some of the best doctors, like Dr. Williams, who discovered more vitamins than any other American, Albert St. George, the Nobel laureate who discovered ascorbic acid, vitamin C, Dr. Ellis, the world's leading authority on B6, and each of these people and a whole lot more got up and made a presentation. It was a whole eight-hour schedule. One of them were the Shute brothers, two brothers, medical doctors, specializing in cardiology. They had one of the most interesting presentations I've ever seen. First, they had meticulously documented how they save people with diabetic conditions, neuropathy more often than not, where you really can't feel that you have an injury to your foot, and then it becomes infected and you lose the foot or a toe. And it showed before and after treatments with vitamin E, but at very high doses. We're talking about in the thousands of doses, 2,000, 3,000. And all these other heart conditions, they were able to help people. And they explained that they had over 30,000 cases they had worked with and reversed a lot of cases, otherwise people would have died. I would later see no study supporting vitamin E, and one of my very first debates was with a physician who would later be one of the leading quack doctors in America, but he himself was totally discredited in one of his testimonies when we found out about his background. But in any case, he and I were debating on national television, and he suggested that vitamin E really didn't have any efficacy. Well, it didn't if you use too low a dose, and therein was the key. I had looked at thousands of studies that really didn't show vitamin E did anything, but they were at 100 units, sometimes 200 units, and a big dose was considered 250 units, whereas the people who were showing positive results were using 600, 800, 1,000 units or higher. When you looked at that data, it was an ocean of good. Higher the vitamin E, the better the results. This is in the Journal of Lipid Research. This is just brand new. Quote, how vitamin E deficiency damages the brain. In this article, they explain how a sufficient intake of vitamin E would help protect the brain from lipid peroxidation and its damaging effects. Well, consider that over one-third of your brain is lipids. So if you could stop lipid peroxidation or oxidation, that's a big way of helping your brain, especially to keep your brain young and vital and not laced with little fatty deposits, the amyloid plaques. According to Oregon State University, that evaluated the effects of lifelong vitamin E deficiency in this study, they found that you really damage your brain. Now, here's the takeaway message. You don't need a lot of vitamin E. It's the type you get that counts. My suggestion, natural mix tocopherols and natural mix tocotrienols. The gamma, the beta, the delta, the theta. Get your mix. It's in the mixture that you get your best effects. And then it helps oxidize the blood. It helps space the red blood cells. It's one of the best anti-stroke, anti-blood coagulating things you can do. It helps lower blood pressure. And boy, applied topically to sores and wounds, it helps there. And then I go way back to the very beginning, and I remember what the Shute brothers were saying about vitamin E and seeing all those photographs before and after. So we have been blessed by having some great science. The trouble is they never got any publicity. Now, also, there's good research on increasing the lycopene, lyco, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E, P-E-N-E, and lowering your kidney cancer risk. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Cancer, and they reported a finding among participants in the Women's Health Initiative. That's a big study. Of lowering the risk of renal, that's kidney, cell carcinoma, by increasing lycopene, that's the red pigment, in watermelon, in tomatoes, raspberries. And so, in fact, they looked at 96,000 postmenopausal women over a six-year period, and then followed them up for an additional 15 years. So this is a high-quality study, and they found that the more lycopene you have, there's your red fruits, eat them, drink the juice or the powders, you can decrease your risk by up to 39%. That's a huge difference. By one nutrient, we're talking about one nutrient. And another great nutrient that Americans don't use, most people don't have never heard of it, is L-carnitine. Carni, C-A-R-N-I, teen, T-I-N-E. This is in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition, and it showed a group of men receiving 1,000 milligrams, generally comes in 500 milligram tablets, or a placebo for 12 weeks. And one of the markers that people never have measured, and we should all have it measured twice a year if you're over the age of 40, men and women, is called C-reactive protein. Also, I like to measure interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha. Because all of these, when they're elevated, that means you've got inflammation going on. You may not know it, you may not feel it, but that inflammation could be in your heart, in the valves, the muscle itself, or in the arteries. And that's a silent killer. Among those that received 1,000 milligrams of L-carnitine, all of these inflammatory markers were lower compared to the placebo. Quote, "We suggest that L-carnitine supplementation may have potential utility to reduce inflammation in coronary artery disease." That's the MD-PhD who headed this study. So one way to save lives. Now, another one is we're told that you shouldn't be having testosterone. Well, synthetic testosterone, yes, I agree, but natural testosterone enhancement, I also agree, is important. In this article, along with age and blood pressure and hypertension, diabetes and total HDL, cholesterol and gender, all those are considered risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And males experience their first cardiovascular event up to 10 years earlier than women, and overall life expectancy in men is approximately 8 years shorter than for females. And the Framingham Heart Study found that hard cardiovascular disease death rates for males was 18.3% and women was 7.6%. And what we found is that a lot of this has to do with testosterone. And in this population-based study, they evaluated the risk of cardiovascular death, all causes of cardiovascular disease in men and women, and the added risk of a low testosterone in men. It was 4,000 men in this study. And compared with women, men were at a higher risk of cardiovascular death, including hypertension and metabolic syndrome, there's your diabetes, when they had very low testosterone. So, big difference. So when you're eating a plant-based diet, you have more than natural precursors to creating testosterone and free testosterone in your body. Now, here's something good for everyone, and that is nuts. This is the latest study from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. They examined 134,000 individuals, and they found, quote, "Eating a handful of nuts is associated with a 20% reduced rate of all causes of death and death from cardiovascular disease also." How about that? So eat the nuts. I suggest nuts because they're high in fiber, high in phenolics compounds, high in the unsaturated fatty acids, good sources of arginine and other phytochemicals, and they're all good. Walnuts, almonds, pistachios, pecans, macadamias, they're all good for your heart. And they reduce oxidative stress, and they're anti-inflammatory, and they help heal the endothelial and maintain it. So, good all the way. And finally, vitamin K2 improves arterial function and cardiovascular outcomes in older women, let's say over the age of 50. This is based upon a study in the peer-reviewed journal Thrombosis, found that supplementation of vitamin K2 can reduce the risk of age-related arterial wall stiffness in middle-aged women. This was a randomized, double-blind trial, and you don't have to have a lot. They had 200 micrograms. I would suggest you could have 1 milligram would be fine. Doesn't take much. And finally, from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, they published the results of treatment with 7,000 units of vitamin D3 benefited HIV-positive children and young adults. And that's good. It was over a 12-month period. It made a big difference in their overall immune responses. So if you know anyone who is suffering from any of the 30-plus AIDS-related conditions, make sure they're getting 5 to 10,000 units of vitamin D3 per day. Well, I mentioned green tea also. I'll just share this with you. This is from Molecular Nutrition Food Research. Reports that a compound found in green tea can kill oral cancer cells by triggering a process in the mitochondria, which leads to cell death while leaving healthy cells alone. Now, this audience knows that it's the EGCG, and that stands for epigallocatechin 3-gallate, and that is working to protect your mitochondria. So get your green tea every day. So if something helps protect the mouth from having cancer, why wouldn't it also protect from cancers throughout the body? And the more you restrict calories, the less inflammation you have in the body. That's from Yale University, published in Nature Medicine. So if you want to restrict inflammation, and we all should because that can lead to heart disease and cancers and diabetes, Alzheimer's, and all forms of mental conditions, get rid of the excess calories, meat and breads and hot dogs and desserts. There's your extra calories. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break and come back. Whole lot more to share. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. Glenn Ford has something to say about the two-party system. There's never been a dime's worth of difference between the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, and Barack Obama. And less than 10 cents separates the worldviews of these Democrat political twins from the Bush wing of the Republican Party. According to Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report, quote, each has their individual quirks. Barack destroys international order and the rule of law while dabbling at a song. Bill dismantled the U.S. manufacturing base and threw record numbers of blacks in prison as he toyed with his trumpet. George W. played the fool who would shock and awe the world into obedience, and Hillary is the evil crone that curses the dead while screaming, "We are women," like a banshee. But they are all the same in their corporate soullessness. They all lie for a living, and they live to lie. Hillary Clinton commingled official and personal criminality through the medium of email. Knowing that, in a life dedicated to crime, she could never successfully squelch her private and public conspiracies, and in the perfect spirit of neoliberalism, Hillary privatized all of her email correspondence during her tenure as Obama's Secretary of State. The fate of millions of Haitians whose country's earthquake and development aid are under the Clinton family thumb were doubtless bundled into the tens of thousands of messages she erased on leaving Foggy Bottom. Republicans have harassed her ever since, seeking an electronic smoking gun to show Clinton's cowardice or lack of resolve to stand up for America and our troops or some other nonsense. What the Benghazi affair actually proves is that the Obama administration was just as intent as Republicans to maintain the fiction that the rebels put in power by 7 months of NATO bombing of Libya were not various flavors of Islamic jihadists, some of whom were already turning on their erstwhile masters. The U.S.-Saudi project to create and nurture the International Jihadist Network is a bipartisan venture that dates back to Jimmy Carter's presidency, and therefore nothing for Democrats and Republicans to fight about. However, the GOP churning of Clinton's emails does provide a glimpse into her quest to run for president in 2016 as the woman who vanquished Gaddafi. Hillary best expressed the ghoulishness of America's ruling duopoly. A number of Clinton correspondences were with Sidney Blumenthal, a former Clinton family spin master who wrote nasty things about Barack Obama while working for Hillary's 2008 presidential campaign, which made it impossible for her to hire him at the State Department. Nevertheless, Clinton needed his talents for hype for the damage and campaign ahead. Their emails in December 2011 discussed how Hillary's status as stateswoman could soar when the Libyan leader was finally eliminated. Quote, "This is a historic moment and you will be credited for realizing it," wrote Blumenthal, feeding the crone's huge gizzard of ego. According to an article in the New York Times, "You must go on camera," wrote Blumenthal. "You must establish yourself in the historical record at this moment." Hillary was anxious to seize the time to establish what Blumenthal described as the Clinton Doctrine. The Times piece somehow concludes that Obama stole Clinton's thunder with a 1,100-word speech in late August, declaring the Gaddafi regime is coming to an end and the future of Libya is in the hands of its people. But Hillary best expressed the ghoulishness of America's ruling duopoly 2 months later in October when Gaddafi was savagely butchered by screaming jihadists. Quote, "We came, we saw, he died," she cackled. In the annals of global diplomacy, no more vulgar words have been spoken by a major foreign minister or head of state, yet Clinton's calculated quip perfectly encapsulates the bloodlust that is the common characteristic of both the governing duopoly of the United States and their suckling children in ISIS and other proliferating al-Qaeda factions. Thanks to Seymour Hersh, we now have a much more plausible scenario. For the May 2, 2011 demise of Osama bin Laden and the U.S.-Saudi-spawned global jihad, whose body will never be located, that's, of course, bin Laden's body, virtually the entire U.S. account of his death is a lie, repeatedly contradicted on its own terms, another layer of fictional Americana in the age of empire and decline. Jihadists find it difficult to take orders from infidels, even when the crusaders are paying the bills and supplying the weapons. Clinton was hard-pressed to imagine how she might trump the president's bin Laden death watch extravaganza. Her opportunity came 5 months later when she delivered her gruesome paraphrase of Julius Caesar on the occasion of Colonel Gaddafi's murder. In the context of Washington's deeply racist foreign policy, Gaddafi and bin Laden were equally deserving of death. Although Gaddafi was among the most fervent and effective fighters against Islamic jihadists, his government was the first in the world to request a global arrest warrant against bin Laden. The Libyan Islamists were quickly transferred to the U.S., NATO, Saudi, Qatari front lines in Syria. The CIA station in Benghazi was at the center of the action and got burned in the wild and unwieldy process of herding jihadists who find it difficult to follow our orders, even as we're paying their bills and supplying the weapons. The U.S. consulate and the CIA station in Benghazi were attacked on September 11, 2012. The next day, the Pentagon's intelligence agency issued a report predicting that a Salafist principality, another term for an Islamic state, would likely arise in Syria as a result of the war, and that Western countries, the Gulf states and Turkey, are supporting these efforts. Moreover, the establishment of such an Islamic principality would create the, quote, ideal atmosphere for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became ISIS, ISIL, in the Islamic State, to return to its old pockets in Mosul and Ramadi, end quote, in Iraq. Events that, sure enough, they've transpired. The Defense Intelligence Agency report didn't say so, but the Western powers, including the United States, through its CIA. The Pentagon warning about the rise of an Islamic State may have had some effect on U.S. policy in Syria. The document was declassified this year as a result of a suit by a libertarian right-wing legal outfit. The people of the world continue to be fed the fiction that the U.S. is engaged in a long twilight struggle against Al-Qaeda, Salafists, whose international network was created by and continues to benefit from, quote, Western countries, the Gulf states, and Turkey. However, the 2012 Pentagon warning about the rise of an Islamic State may have some effect on U.S. policy in Syria. 1 year later, September 2013, President Obama backed off from his threat to bomb Syria into its position retaliation for the chemical missile attack against civilians, a crime much more likely committed by Western-backed Salafists. By the way, did you see last week, this is an aside, where they now have officially come forward and says the Islamic State has been using biological weapons? Yeah, and they were using it, and we were the only radio program. And by the way, we challenged the other programs on Pacifica that were pro-destroying and invading Libya and Syria. But we haven't heard a word from the left of challenging the wrongheadedness of that because they don't take on these issues. There is absolutely no introspection on the left on these at all, including privatization of some of its most important assets. But that's a different day and a different story. Hypocrisy is nothing new. I think that high Pentagon officials and elements of Obama administration, probably including the president himself, took the Benghazi disaster and the Defense Intelligence Agency report to heart and decided it was better to keep leading the Syrians and their Russian, Lebanese, and Iranian allies through a prolonged war than to bomb Al-Qaeda into power. For the U.S., the regional chaos is preferable to the triumph of an ultimately unmanageable Salafist unchained. Now, I'm sure you've all heard some rap music that you question, other rap music you can appreciate. But one of the rappers who also had a philosophy about use your power, use your celebrity to go into the ghettos, to go into the disenfranchised communities, the oppressed communities, and use that in a constructive way to help the people. But not everyone shares that opinion. This is a short piece. Tupac warned us about rappers like Young Thug and others like him.
The Ferguson situation. What do you think needs to be changed in the way black men are policed in America?
Lead that up with the critics and the laws and all that old shit. We having fun. We iced out. We having money. That's how we doing it.
So you feel like it's not the artist's place to speak on social issues?
No.
How can these people be talking about how they so real and they don't care about our communities? How can they be talking about what they all this, you know, the hood, blah, 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 blah. They don't care about our communities. You know what I mean? Listen to the words that people say in their lyrics and tell me if that's some real, if that's real to you. You know what I mean? Listen to what they're saying. Don't just bob your head to the beat. Peep the game and listen to what I'm saying and hold us accountable for it.
Also, this is from Margaret Kimberly, Counterpunch. It's short, but I think relevant. Obama's Prison Charade. Quote, the list of Barack Obama's crimes is a long one, but one of the worst is his refusal to even attempt a dismantling of the mass incarceration state in America. In criminal justice, as in other issues, Obama fakes left. Well, the nation loves that, don't they? And MSNBC, and Mother Jones, while actually moving to the right. He is suddenly interested in reform and is on a cross-country marketing blitz meant to burnish his image and fool uninformed people. The White House recently announced that the president would commute prison sentences for dozens of federal prisoners who were convicted for nonviolent drug-related offenses. There are 208,000 federal prison inmates. 448% of them were convicted of narcotics violation. 100,000 are under federal jurisdiction who could be given some consideration if narcotic sentencing laws were changed. The slap in the face was worse than expected when a grand total of 46 people had their sentences commuted. Obama perfected the art of political marketing, which, like all advertising, makes lies appear to be true. In 2013, the president had an opportunity to free at least 5,000 black people from federal prisons. They were all in prison before the 2010 Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the power of powder crack cocaine sentences from 100-to-1 ratio to 18-to-1 ratio. The act did nothing for those sentenced prior, and the White House successfully appealed a federal court ruling which would have given those persons the right to request resentencing. The appeals court ruled in the Obama Justice Department's favor, but no one knows that except for readers of Black Agenda Report. Formerly well-respected organizations such as the NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, lamented the decision without mentioning that the president supported it and took an active role in keeping their clients in prison. Obama is a master of appearing to do what he doesn't do. That's not all marketing skill. He also relies on a compliant corporate media and a spineless black misleadership class to fool nearly all the people all the time. His sudden desire to look like the great emancipator is an ongoing publicity junket. It's important to remember that Obama is still a duplicitous black stabber, backstabber, but the lesser evil, but the more effective evil. He has the power to prosecute killer vigilantes like George Zimmerman and police who murder Eric Garner and Michael Brown, and yet he refused to do so, despite the hoopla surrounding the freeing of 46 people. He falls short of the pardons given by his predecessors. He has yet to use any of the powers at his disposal to bring justice to black people. Of course, he will show up at El Reno and use black people as a propaganda backdrop, but those people can expect little else from him. It is insulting to the extreme for the president to talk about incarceration as some knotty problem he can't quite figure out when he could have given thousands of people the right to seek their freedom. Obama is able to play the same game over and over because he is enabled by his idol-worshipping defenders. They never met an Obama lie they didn't like, and they're happy to help him appear powerless when it suits him. The president can claim and exercise a right to assassinate American citizens without charge of trial, exact regime change in Libya, or give billions to Ukraine, but suddenly claims to be impotent if black Americans need help for any reason. After the meager justice dispensed for 46 people, Obama took his phony show on the road at the annual NAACP convention. The once august organization is a leader among misleaders, giving Obama cover in exchange for access and money. There was no better arena for the president to give an appearance of substance when he really offers only an illusion. End quote. My thoughts. What does it say about us when we have had over 7 million Americans incarcerated? 1 in every 100. What is it when the majority of these are for nonviolent offenses? Shouldn't all those be pardoned? Every single one. and only keep those individuals in prison who have shown that they have committed crimes of such a nature that they could not coexist in a society at that time, and get away with, just give up on the war on drugs. It has failed miserably to prevent drugs, but it succeeded masterfully for creating massive organized crime throughout the world. You would think we would be smarter. We are, for those who profit from the gaming of the system. Giving a few people, a couple dozen people, a pardon. Think of the hundreds of thousands of people he could have pardoned, at least a 500,000, that could be back with their families, starting their life over, expunge their record, so they could go in and have no record and start their life anew. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's hear how you can get fired real quick for saying things that, well, you can hear on progressive media. You sure can't hear it on conservative media.
Does the government work for us, or do we work for the government? Tonight, what if the Constitution no longer applied? What if the whole purpose of the Constitution was to limit the government? What if Congress's enumerated powers in the Constitution no longer limited Congress, but were actually used as a justification to extend Congress's authority over every realm of human life? What if the president, meant to be an equal to Congress, has instead become a democratically elected, term-limited monarch? What if the president assumed that everything he did was legal just because he's the president? What if he could interrupt your regularly scheduled radio and TV programming for a special message from him? What if he could declare war on his own? What if he could read your emails and your texts without a search warrant? What if he could kill you without warning? What if Supreme Court justices no longer looked to the Constitution to determine the constitutionality of a law, but rather simply to what justices who preceded them thought about it? What if the rights and principles guaranteed in the Constitution have been so distorted in the past 200 years as to be unrecognizable by the founders? What if the 50 states were no longer sovereign entities, equals to each other, and parents of the federal government they voluntarily constituted? What if the states were mere provinces of a totally nationalized and fully centralized government? What if the Constitution was amended stealthily, not by constitutional amendments duly ratified by the states, but by the constant and persistent expansion of the federal government's role in our lives? What if the federal government decided if its own powers were proper and constitutional? What if the Constitution were no longer the supreme law of the land? What if you needed a license from the government to speak, to assemble, or to protest against the government? What if the government didn't like what you planned to say, and so it didn't give you the license? What if the right to keep and bear arms only applied to the government? What if posse comitatus, the federal law that prohibits our military from occupying our streets, were no longer in effect? What if the government considered the military an adequate dispenser of domestic law enforcement? What if cops looked and acted like troops and you couldn't distinguish the military from the police? What if you were not secure in your person, in your papers, and in your property? What if federal agents could write their own search warrants in defiance of the Constitution? What if the government could decide when you were and were not entitled to a jury trial? What if the government could take your property whenever it wanted? What if the government could continue prosecuting you until it got the verdict it wanted? What if the government could force you to testify against yourself simply by labeling you a domestic terrorist? What if the government could torture you until you said what the government wanted to hear? What if people running for president actually supported torture? What if the government tortured your children to get to you? What if government judges and government lawyers intimidated juries into convicting the innocent? What if the government could send you to your death and your innocence meant nothing so long as the government's procedures were followed? What if America's prison population, the largest in the world, was a cruel and unusual way for a country to be free? What if half the prison population never harmed anyone but themselves? What if the people had no rights except those the government chose to let them have? What if the states had no rights except to do as the federal government commanded? What if our elected officials didn't really live among us, but instead all had their hearts and homes in Washington, D.C.? What if the government could strip you of your rights because of where your mother was when you were born? What if the income tax was unconstitutional? What if the states were convinced to give up their representation in Congress? What if the government tried to ban you from using a substance in your body that is older than the government itself? What if voting didn't mean anything anymore because both political parties stand for big government? What if the government could write any law, regulate any behavior, and tax any event? The Constitution be damned. What if the government was the reason we don't have a constitution anymore? What if you could love your country but hate what the government has done to it? What if sometimes, to love your country, you had to alter or abolish the government? What if Jefferson was right? What if that government is best which governs least? What if I'm right? What if the government is wrong? What if it is dangerous to be right when the government is wrong? What if it is better to perish fighting for freedom than to live as a slave? What if freedom's greatest hour of danger is now?
And for that, he was fired. That's Judge Napolitano. On many issues, I could take issue, but I'm one of those people who've seen in all my investigative reporting throughout my many decades of this life of how the government no longer serves the people. We serve the corporate interests of the government because you cannot separate out corporate from government. It is fascism. Everywhere. Just take two segments of the government. Take the military-industrial complex and take the medical-industrial complex. Put them both together, you're dealing with $4.5 trillion a year. Does one make us safer? No. That could be done with about $100 billion a year. We could save the rest. And are we healthier because of our current medical monopolies and the way we treat people? No. No, there are countries around the world that you live a longer life, you're healthier, and they have universal health care, something that we seem to fear, at least those who wouldn't profit from universal health care. Put them together and suddenly you see how much power the government has over us. And yet people go through their days clueless about this. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back, and we're going to go to our guests at that point. Let me mention before we do, I'm looking forward this Sunday at noon to being at the Huntington Art Cinema in Long Island. I'm not going to give the number anymore because most people simply get their tickets by showing up on Sunday. I'll be there this coming Sunday. And also, I had an interesting idea based upon what someone came in while I was having a juice over the weekend and said, I want to give this to you. And I didn't know I'd meet you in here. I was going to leave it for you. And it's a picture of an outdoor cover dish dinner on Long Island from 1975. And she said, I came to that. There's so many people that we had to take over the entire parking lot. It was the most fun. And she said, I just thought you'd like to have it. And I was thinking, what if we did a montage of not the pictures I have and I put up on my website, but the photographs and people in this audience, the lectures, the workshops, the dinners, the dances, the athletic events, the book signings, all the ways that we have interrelated over these many years. So here's the deal. You can send them over to us. If you don't know how to scan them, we'll scan them and give them back to you. You can drop them off. And if you just go to 89th and Broadway, if you're in the town, you can drop them off. But I'll give you our address here before the show's out. You just stick them in an envelope and send it to me. And we'll make a whole, over the next month, we'll collect all these and we'll make a wonderful historical tour that we can see and let everyone see them. It'll be fun. All right? Let's take a break and come back with my guest.
I do.
Let's say hello to Professor Eric Lomas. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We often look back at the labor and union movement as a positive time for the improvement of workers' conditions and environmental protections in the workplace, and many of the consumer protection acts initiated by Ralph Nader to keep our workspaces safe. However, over the years, I've noticed corporations have discovered ways to get around all that, and especially after the passing of trade laws such as NAFTA that permitted manufacturing and industry to halt in the United States, move offshore. I personally consider NAFTA and other trade laws during the Clinton years as some of the worst decisions in American labor history. It opened the doors to widespread corruption, the frenzy of deregulation to benefit corporate oligarchs, and demolished unions and domestic production. It's as if everything that had been accomplished in the early part of the 20th century with improved working conditions was lost. And today, corporations in the United States remain some of the largest toxic polluters. We only have to look at the fossil fuel and chemical agricultural industries for proof of how serious and bad the situation is with workers and their families and in the vicinity of these private operations having some of the worst health, the most environmentally caused diseases, and the higher mortality rates and birth defects. And so please first begin with a brief history of the advances labor made that made U.S. industry a model for the world, and then highlight the primary events that eroded this away and gave rise to the corporation's ability to run roughshod over workers with no regard for the environment and the health of their workers. The forum is yours.
Sure. My book basically is a history of effectively what you've just said. I mean, you know, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, conditions in the United States for workers and for citizens were really awful. Workers died all the time at work, in coal mine accidents, in fires at factories, just one by one through getting caught in a saw or something of this nature. At the same time, pollution ran rampant. And, you know, the book takes the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911 as a moment where Americans began to say, hey, wait a minute. We need our corporations to act more responsibly. And the reason for that, the reason it's that moment, is because that incident, which takes place in a fashionable section of New York City, where 146 young, mostly immigrant women died, was in the sight, in the literal physical sight of the people who were purchasing the clothes that were being made in that sweatshop. And so wealthy people saw these workers dying, and that led to a number of immediate reforms around workplace safety, fire safety, building safety, et cetera. That sort of begins a longer trend throughout much of the 20th century of Americans saying we demand more corporate responsibility toward workers and eventually toward the environment. And it leads to the minimum wage, it leads to the 8-hour day, it leads to unionization. Eventually, it begins to lead to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. And so by the time you're looking at the 1960s, and into the 70s, the America has improved a tremendous amount. Workers have a fair share of the pie. The environment is becoming cleaner. But for corporations, this was never acceptable. And they always looked for ways out of it. And so what they begin to do, and really even pioneering this as early as the 1910s and 20s by moving unionized textile factories from New England to the South, was trying to escape those regulations. Well, what really begins to happen by the mid-1960s is that the federal government is now basically encouraging companies to escape some of these restrictions by moving a lot of heavy industry overseas. And the real key moment in this is the 1965 border industrialization program in Mexico, where Mexico effectively invites American industry just over the border for low-wage work where they can, again, pollute, et cetera. And this is the rise of the maquiladoras. And at that moment, corporations begin to realize that they can really escape all of these regulations. And so by the late 1970s, you talked about NAFTA, and NAFTA is a huge event in this. But really, NAFTA is sort of the culmination of what had already been going on for 20 years, which was corporations realizing they could move overseas. And so you know, by the 70s and the 80s, this is happening in huge numbers. Then after NAFTA, of course, even more, and it becomes global. Eventually, Mexican labor gets too expensive for a lot of these companies, and they begin to move to China, and then they begin to move to Honduras and Nicaragua and Cambodia, and most notoriously, Bangladesh, where in 2013, over 1,100 workers died. Again, just like in the Triangle Fire, in the apparel industry, in conditions almost exactly the same as the Triangle Fire, with unsafe working conditions and great oppression of those workers. Similarly, like the textile industry of 100 years ago, that industry in Bangladesh can pollute all they want to. And who are they making these clothes for? They're making them for Walmart. They're making them for Target. They're making them for The Gap, and these corporations are doing everything they can to make sure that even though over 1,100 workers died making their clothes, that nothing is done to hold them accountable. And so basically what I'm trying to say here is that there's a history. We can do it. We can create a better life for ourselves and a better life for our for workers around the country and even around the world. But we have to start taming corporate behavior. We have to start stopping the ability of corporations to move anywhere they want around the world in order to avoid unions, in order to avoid pollution standards. And if we don't do that, not only are we dooming the middle class in the United States, but we're assuring that workers around the world are never able to create a middle class of their own, because as soon as they unionize and as soon as their wages begin to rise, the companies move on to yet another country.
We know that U.S. firms benefit, as you mentioned, from slave labor conditions overseas. You mentioned Bangladesh, Indonesia is another, India, and of course China, and other poorer nations where labor laws are very weak or non-existent or not enforced. How about in the United States? How is slave labor continuing here?
Well, what happens is, in part of the story that I tell here is, as these companies move overseas, what they do is they destroy unions, right? I mean, if you're, you used to have the United Steelworkers was a huge union. Now they're a small union because all those jobs have been lost. The the United Auto Workers is the same. The United Rubber Workers don't even exist anymore. And so what happens is that every time that these jobs are moved overseas or moved somewhere else, you are taking, you're destroying those unions. And that's what corporations are trying to do, is destroy these unions. And when you destroy a union, what you do is you take the ability of workers to influence politics away. You take the money of those union dues that was used to ensure that Washington gave at least a relatively fair shake to workers, and you take it out of the system. And that has all kinds of major impacts, such as Citizens United, right? Now corporations have more control over this country than they have at least since the 1920s, if not the 19th century. And that's because workers' voices are no longer valued in Washington because they don't have any kind of organized way of impacting politics. The other thing, among the many other things that it does, is it says to workers, don't support environmental protections. If you support environmental protection, well then we're going to move your jobs overseas. So it makes them too scared to do so. But it also opens up, as you mentioned, it opens up new forms of exploitative labor in the United States. And so, what you see is in places, sweatshops in Los Angeles, for instance, or, one example I talk about in the book is that Walmart had been contracting out for some of their frozen seafood with a Louisiana contractor who was bringing workers up from Mexico and locking them in his factory so they could not escape, effectively slave labor in Louisiana. And it took a tremendous amount of bravery by those workers to reach out and sneak a message out to a labor organization to get their lives, to get these horrors of their lives exposed. And so this sort of thing happens more and more and more because you don't have the ability of organized labor anymore to fight against this. The structures that Americans created to ensure a fair shake for workers, to ensure that slave labor doesn't take place anymore, have been largely dismantled. And so who knows? I mean, there was this example again in Louisiana, but who knows how common that is? We don't know. It's probably relatively fairly common, and it just, this one story came out. So, yes, this is a huge problem. And for every...
Eric, hold your thoughts for a moment. because for some of our stations, we'll say thank you for listening today and we'll look forward to tomorrow. But I'm going to extend your interview a bit here because I haven't got to the most important issue for me right now, and that's what we're going to address. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is, to me, the worst treaty in American history. If you thought NAFTA was bad, this is NAFTA on steroids. It could undo all of our environmental and health protections. It could completely destroy the labeling of the GMO movement, of which I've been a part, as have Jeffrey Smith and others, trying to get foods that are genetically engineered labeled so a person has a freedom of choice to say, yes, I'll buy it, or no, I won't. And it also would mean that we literally would be facing state and federal and corporate bankruptcies if we decided not to allow the exploitation of something in the United States because someone from outside the United States wanted to do something here, and we didn't want them to because they didn't meet our current laws, because we would no longer have any laws, including clear up the Supreme Court, federal laws, state laws, county laws. All that would be subordinated to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's all been done in secret. Now, why haven't the unions created a general strike? Why not just shut down America to show, is there any power left in that movement, or have some of the leadership of some of these movements align themselves with the president on this, or Democrats, because they still have favors coming in their direction? I would take everyone out on strike to stop this and bring America to a standing still, not all of it, of course, but a lot of it, to say, we don't want this treaty. We don't want any form of this treaty. Stop it. Your thoughts on the Trans-Pacific Partnership being fast-tracked, how Congress was bought out on this. And I see Obama doing the same thing that Clinton did, playing with the same rule book, buying the votes. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a terrible law. It's a terrible treaty, and it's a real threat for some of the reasons that you mentioned. I mean, I think that, you know, you reference in passing the investor state dispute settlement courts, which already exist to some level, but as you say, have the ability, you know, if a company, you know, if the United States passes some new law, say that we raise the minimum wage nationally, and we raise it to $15 an hour, some people are saying, well, it's possible that another country that is a member of the Trans-Pacific Partnership or one of these other trade deals that we're negotiating right now could potentially use this ISDS court to sue the United States, and if the U.S. is found guilty, as it were, then the U.S. has to pay this company, quote, you know, all expected future profits. And so that really disincentivizes the ability to create new environmental legislation to raise the minimum wage. I mean, it's a real and serious threat, and you already see companies doing this around the world. So, for instance, the Egyptians raised their minimum wage, and the French company is suing them. Philip Morris is trying to sue Paraguay for cracking down on tobacco use. And so this is a real serious threat, and I think that, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership both, you know, makes it even easier to outsource jobs, although the jobs are already mostly outsourced, and you know, so it just kind of facilitates that. But also, you know, it extends pharmaceutical monopolies over drugs. It you know, it has these ISDS courts, and these are very, very problematic things. And, you know, I think what makes it even worse here is that the Obama administration, I think Obama really just truly believes that this is going to somehow help Americans, it's really disturbing that he thinks this.
Eric, I don't believe that at all. We have a different opinion on that, but we're out of time. I appreciate all your good work, Eric. Eric Lomas, Loomis, author of Out of Sight, The Long Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe. The address to send in photographs, and you'll get them back, and we'll share them with everyone. From any point at any time, please send them to Gary Nall, 2421 Broadway, New York, New York, 10024. Gary Nall, 2421 Broadway, New York, New York, 10024. Have a nice day, everyone.